cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Carol, we've all been there. A moment where you want to say something, where you want to speak up, where you want to be heard, but instead, for a whole host of reasons, you just stay quiet.
I did it for a long time. I was so quiet and so actually shy, if you will. Hard to believe.
I wasn't going to say anything.
It's okay.
You said it yourself.
I did.
It turns out, though, that keeping quiet in those moments can, according to our next guest, really hold us back in life. I'm not just talking personally, but also professionally, too.
Interesting. All right. Elaine Lynn Herring is a lecturer at Harvard Law School. She's worked with corporations, government organizations, NGOs, including American Express, Google, Nike, Pixar, the Red Cross, and many more. She, Tim, has a new book out.
Yeah, it's called Unlearning Silence, How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent, and Live More Fully. She joins us from the San Francisco Bay Area. It's good to have you with us, Elaine. How are you?
I'm good, and I'm so glad to hear that Carol's already spilling the tea about her life.
I know. Well, you do that a lot in your book, actually. You open with a scene from earlier in your career about not actually taking credit or somebody else taking credit for work that you've done. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. It is a dynamic that, as I have worked with clients across industries, across continents, seems to happen all too often. You have done all the work, then someone else gets the credit. And to say something, to say, hey, that was me, seems petty. And it really gets at the core of how do we speak up? How do we get seen? How do we get what we need at work and at home?
Wait, can I counter though? Because that happens a lot in a work scene where just somebody's like, somebody did something, but they don't get the credit. And like how much
Hello,
of it...
to the producers of our show.
But I mean...
Literally do so much.
Exactly. Like, when is it petty? Or when is it like, no, I should speak up? Because it comes up so often. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of people, you just kind of turn and look the other direction. But so what's the right balance here? When do you really speak up? When should you be like, no? And where is your colleagues of saying, no, wait, this person really did it?
Yes. And I love that Tim is already starting to speak up on behalf of producers at this show, because that to the question of when should you speak up, my argument is you should speak up if it is what you want to do, if you have that agency to do it. The difference between silence that is additive or silence that is damaging is when it feels like you can't do it because the costs are too high. And yet we all know in terms of promotion, in terms of merit increases, getting credit for the work that you've done does matter.
So how early is too early to start talking about this stuff? And the reason I ask is because I actually had a parent-teacher conference yesterday on Zoom.
Love it.
With my son's pre-K teacher. So he's five, he's in pre-K before kindergarten. And this was the big area for improvement that she wanted him to work on.
To speak up?
To speak up.
Interesting.
Especially when he's in groups of people, more so than just with his, you know, his best friend.
Yeah.
And she's noticed it when they're literally, like, they're playing at school. That's what they do. And I asked her, like, you know, what are the tools that you have to teach a kid that young to do those things? So I'm going to use my time with you, Elaine, to get that advice.
I love that this is a real intervention. And I'd also argue that speaking up contrary to what your son's pre-K teacher might be saying, doesn't always have to come in the form of words. Hmm. The real question about using your voice is, are you getting what you need? Is your son getting the attention that he needs? Is he getting the care and the development that he needs? And how do we each flex and develop different skills that we might need? So I'd be curious, to the extent that a five-year-old can articulate, are they getting what they need in that classroom?
So you need to talk to what, Arlo then?
Yeah, he wasn't playing with the magnetiles the same way that the other kids were. So that's where it comes from.
All I know is you share with me things he says. He's a super smart kid and very observant.
We're very lucky.
Well, because there is something to, I mentioned I was very shy as a kid, and I know it's really hard to believe that probably today, but I was painfully shy. But I have a lot of older siblings, and one of my sister's older sister says, what you do is you observe a lot. Mm-hmm. And then you're sometimes slow to the party, but when you do, you kind of hit it hard. And so that balance of observing and learning, you know, being the squeaky wheel. Some squeaky wheels do really well. Some you hear managers be like, they're annoying. Like, so like, what are all these balances?
Yeah. And my call to action, my invitation in the book is really for each of us to examine in what ways might we have internalized and learned silence for ourselves. So we're not asking and advocating for how I want to play with magnetiles, and that should be just fine for me to play with the magnetiles the way I want to. And because our lives all intersect with each other, in what ways might we be silencing our colleagues? Might we be not creating the space for their ideas, their genius to come forth?
Hey,
it really is looking at it from all angles.
Elaine, we only have a minute left, and I'm interested to know, why for so many adults it's so hard for them in the workplace to ask for what they want?
Yeah, my answer is we've all learned to be silent, and at work we've often been rewarded for it, right? Don't rock the boat, keep the peace, be a good team player. And the traditional advice around speak up is just speak up, just do it. We were just talking about Nike, let's take a line from them. But having taught leadership development around the world, really noticed this pattern of, despite those tools and frameworks to negotiate, have difficult conversations, and give and receive feedback, some people still don't. So if we really want to speak up and create spaces on our teams for people to do so, we need to solve for silence.
Mm. I feel like we're all going to go home and like do a little bit of work. You're going to go home to Arlo and you'd be like, hey, yeah. What do you need? Oh, what do you need in that classroom?
He's well taken care of.
Elaine, this is fun. You can send us both bills because you've definitely helped us. Elaine Lynn
You're
Herring,
welcome.
Be well. Elaine Lynn Herring is a lecturer at Harvard Law School, and she's got a new book out. It is called Unlearning Silence, How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent, and Live More Fully. Joining us there from the San Francisco Bay Area.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know where I'd really like to be right now?
Yeah, I do know exactly.
Because it's cold.
Maybe down south, or maybe on the water on in a yacht?
Sign me
on
up.
On a yacht?
Yes.
On a yacht, yeah.
On a yacht, next to a yacht.
Is that where you want to be?
Yeah, I would like to be there.
Well, I have some good news for you.
Let's go there.
You can go to the Palm Beach International Boat Show because it kicks off today.
It does. It runs through the weekend. And back with us to talk about it and just really talk about the boat business, if you will, is Chuck Cashman. He's Chief Revenue Officer, Executive VP at the publicly held small cap company Marine Max, about a $690 million market cap. He is with us in West Palm Beach, Florida. Chuck, good to have you back with us. How are you? And talk to us a little bit about kind of your world. Let's just talk the business before we get into the boat show. How's been business?
Well, thank you for having me back.
How's business been? Sorry, that was bad English.
Very good. No, business is still very, very good. You know, we're coming off historically great years, so your benchmark gets a little bit different. But if you look back over the 25 years we've been a public company, this would go down as easily a top 3 year. So business is still very good. It feels a little more pressured, and it is a little more pressured, but nonetheless, transactions are happening and business is good.
So business is good. We should note, again, it's a publicly traded company. Stock down a little more than 20% so far this year. About 14% of the float is shorted right now. What do you think the market is missing if business is so good right now?
You know, the news isn't always great, you know, and we don't publish when we make a sale, and it's hard to put a metric on customer interest, consumer interest, and the interest is good. Transactions are happening. There's margin pressure. Profitability is a little harder because interest rates are higher, both for the consumer and for us, right? We have a floor plan on $400 or $500 million worth of inventory that kind of eats into profits. And, you know, I think it's always in advance, the market and the price of our stock. But I'll tell you, through history, it's always been a mystery to me why we don't get a little more value for what we're able to deliver.
And forgive me, the stock did surge today, up 6%. So it down about 18% so far this year.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's we're all a little disappointed, but you know, we run our business for the long term, and at the end of the day, we do believe that if we just keep doing the right thing the right way, we'll eventually get rewarded for it.
Hey, two other news things just real quickly and then we'll move on. But you guys did announce earlier this month a $100 million buyback. You also earlier this month reported on a cybersecurity incident. You guys did say it didn't have a material impact on the operations. What do we need to know? First of all, about the cybersecurity incident, anything more that you know or in terms of its impact?
No, our release said it all. It was, okay. You know, we're very thankful that we're a tech forward company. We had a good plan in place. It happened two Sundays ago in the middle of the night. We were on it first thing Sunday morning. And yes, it was disruptive for sure, but it was monetarily, it just put us a week behind. But I saw a memo come across today that basically said we're back, all systems operational, and you know, you gotta check for fragments of the bad actor that they leave behind, and all that's been cleared, and we've got a blessing of get back to business. So it was disruptive, but not super costly.
And why $100 million buyback? Why do a buyback? Is it just because the stock price has come down, and why not?
It is. Okay. It is. Well, it is. And it shows our confidence in what we're doing. And we believe the stock's of value now.
All right.
So we're gonna buy some back.
Talk to us about, I'm assuming you guys are hoping people are buying at the boat show. So talk to us a little bit about what's up for sale. Who do you see as your buyers, or who are predominantly the buyers in this environment?
Well, this show is so unique. Palm Beach is the epicenter of wealth, and you know, we go to a lot of boat shows in a lot of cities, and you know, this is really a top five boat show in the world. But really, where this show stands tall is 25 meters and up. So you know, call it 80 feet and up. This is a place where you could come and look at some boats if you're that buyer, and get a good representation of the market without having to travel all over the United States to find these boats. And it's the last show of the show season. And it's a very good environment if you're looking for a big boat.
How big?
Well, if you look at the boat behind me on the picture, that boat was the biggest boat displayed here last year. We met the buyer here, and it closed a month later. So, you know, that's 250 feet.
Okay.
We have 150 foot in the show today that That's one of the biggest boats in the show, and you know, we're looking to meet that buyer.
How much was that boat?
Oh, that boat, I want to say, you know, the final price is always under an NDA because of privacy to the buyer and the seller, but probably $125 million.
Well, and talk to us a little bit about supply and demand. Tell us about whether there's a fair amount of more supply right now or there's more demand in the market. We saw a lot of people buying boats coming out of the pandemic, right? They wanted to get out. They wanted to be away from people. Saw that. What are you seeing today?
You know, today we're probably at equilibrium. You know, it was clearly a seller's market the last few years. If you had a boat for sale, you were usually, you know, somewhat similar to real estate, kind of parallels that, where you were getting offers at ask, maybe over ask. You would get a couple offers and you would vet to see which offer suited you best. Now inventory is starting to grow. It hasn't grown to the point where it's a disadvantage, but it's a little more of an advantage. If somebody came in today and wanted to buy a boat, we could sell them a boat. They could go boating this summer, where a couple of years ago, that wasn't the way. So it's, I would say it's equal. It's a little bit of a seller's market, a little bit of a buyer's market. If you have that special boat, which we have some really special boats in our display, you know, the buyer, you know, the seller's got a little advantage because of the special uniqueness of the boat, but the buyer has an advantage because the market is dictating a little more of a concession on price.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but what about chartering right now? Because that's you guys play there too. How's that looking?
You know, chartering is, it's been red hot. And it's kind of in segments. You know, we've expanded in Greece. We're seeing a lot of activity there. We did a recent acquisition, which we've just integrated into our company, and we're in Greece in a bigger way, and we're surprised by the amount of volume, the amount of interest there. You know, charter in the Med for the summer is the early signs are it's going to be a very, very good season. So yeah, charter is still it's a very good segment, and it's a great portal for people to come in and see if they want to own a boat.
You put your vacation request in for chartering in the head yet? No, Carol?
Not yet.
Okay, not yet.
On it. Chuck Cashman, fun to check in with you always. Chief Revenue Officer over at MarineMax and Executive VP.
Hey, we mentioned the S&P 500 just notched its 20th record close this year. The NASDAQ 100 closed at a record. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at a record. This relentless rally in stocks powering ahead on optimism that the Fed is going to be able to engineer a soft landing, that would bolster the outlook for corporate earnings, of course. Let's see what Doug Scioca has to say about all this. He's a CEO and partner at Kavar Capital Partners. He joins us once again from Leawood, Kansas. Doug, how are you? It's good to see you.
Great. Good afternoon. Great to see and hear you both. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming back on with us. How are you watching this from your perch over at Kavar?
Yeah, I mean, just kind of frenetic couple of days, right, with Powell yesterday. And, you know, hard to think he could have been more dovish. I mean, open to the possibility of cutting rates before inflation hits their stated and restated target of both CPI and PCE. And, you know, I feel like it was such a great constructive message, right? It puts them in a position where, yeah, we may still cut, but it'll be for the sake of preserving the recovery as opposed to rescuing the economy. And I think that was obviously the market took that to heart, saw both the bond and the stock rally. And then, like you guys were just talking about, I mean, it was some of the earnings strength that's been demonstrated, not just from technology in the Mag 5, 6, or 7, where they are now, but just across different industry groups. I think that's just kind of bolstered people's enthusiasm that, you know, we're seeing a multiple that had expanded, but now maybe can be sustained.
Well, it's interesting, too. Like, I don't know, how did you kind of get your head around, right, the Fed upping growth projections, but also upping kind of inflationary expectations?
Yeah, with very little expectation of an increased unemployment rate, right?
Yeah.
I think in some ways we squared that with good news is good news, right? And whether it's soft or no or whatever type of descriptive landing we may or may not have, I think what the Fed is trying to do is invoke stability. And they've been criticized over time, and likely deservedly so, of lacking any foresight and preemptive capability with what they're doing with monetary policy. And I think that could end up being the legacy of Powell, that he is trying to go counter to what has become the expectation and be a little bit more clear in his identification of what is one of his, maybe the third, but unstated mandate, which is economic stability. And I think the market plays such a big part of that.
It's so interesting because he spent so much time yesterday at the beginning and at the end reminding everybody what the dual mandate was. And he does this each and every time, Doug. He says, you know, we take our dual mandate very, very seriously. He's just really pounding it into everybody's head. All that being said, how successful of a job do you think he's doing?
Oh, I'd grade it very highly, Tim. And the thing is, like, we have the benefit of Monday morning quarterbacking, right? And I was very critical of Powell in 2022, thinking, like, why does he feel like he needs to do what he's doing? I still remember when Jim Bullard even made a comment like, hey, we may raise rates by 0.75%. We've done it in the past and the world didn't end. Like, geez, if that's your reference point of setting that low of a bar, and then they do it four consecutive times, you kind of felt like, what was your hurry? But I think in recognition of their misunderstanding of the non-transitory nature of the inflationary impact, they felt the catch-up they needed to do. They needed to do the catch-up that they did. And I would say it's been arguably pretty effective from that point forward.
Hey, Doug, you know, we're just getting a few, you know, earnings trickling out as we're pretty much done. We're waiting on Nike and we'll break them as soon as they cross. But we just did, you know, FedEx, which we're seeing this stock rally big time, up about 11% here in the aftermarket. As Tim rightly pointed out, they're authorizing a new $5 billion share buyback program. When companies are continuing to spend on buybacks, how do you read that as an investor? Is that really, I mean, I get why the stock goes up. Right, you buy back shares. I get the math, the supply that's out there, and what that means earnings per share. But as an investor, like, does that make FedEx more interesting to you because of that, or do you question? All right, is that really, if they think that's the best use of $5 billion versus something else? I don't know. How do you read that as an investor?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Carol, because I'll answer the question in sort of the context of sort of the opposite. Perspective. When insiders sell stock, right, we always say there are a lot of reasons that they do that. Mm-hmm. But one of them is not because they think the stock is going to go on some parabolic rip higher. When companies buy their stock back, there are a lot of reasons to do that. There's financial engineering, to your point, on a metric per share basis. It improves the valuation. But they're not doing it because they think the stock is overvalued. So I do think it is a nice signal to Wall Street and to the investor community that they still think there are better days in front of the company, and that's a good use of the free cash flow that they're generating.
Hey, listen, so how are you thinking about, you know, we just had a guest, Cheryl Smith, who said, hey, listen, don't forget recessions start 23 months after interest rate hikes begin. The range is from 15 to 36 months. We're now at 24 months. Do you think about that maybe we've got to see some kind of correction or that we are maybe at some point going to hit that recession, maybe sooner rather than later?
It's a very natural part of the business cycle, obviously. I mean, for us, it's difficult to anticipate or predict a specific time, only in so much as we have such strong underlying economic growth right now. And I think if you pair that economic growth with companies in a very interesting part of their upswing of their profit cycle, plus a labor market that's finally in balance, and think about it too, like the breadth that we've seen in the contribution to the index performance has been really huge. And you guys mentioned regarding Nike, incorporating like EM, like China, which is a huge market. Mm-hmm. And in light of like everything that happened with Apple Computer today, where's Tim Cook? He's in China, right? Yeah. Opening the second largest Apple store in the world after the one on Fifth Avenue, right? This is a market that has actually been discounted in its contributions to American consumer products and technological goods. If that comes in, I think it actually forestalls that recessionary influence even more.
It's a really good point. We talk about that too, that despite all the pushback or at least the tensions between the U.S. and China specifically, you're not seeing executives run away from China. All right, Doug Ciocca, thank you so much. Great to check in with you. Chief Executive Officer, partner as well at Kavar Capital Partners, roughly about $1.25 billion in assets under management, joining us from Leawood, Kansas.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.